Good evening, listeners. Welcome to Damn Radio. If you'd like to call in, please do. Call 573-746-8020 or email live at damradio.com. This is Jack's Car Show. I'm broadcasting live from the Lake Ozark Real Estate of the Arcia. This is Damn Radio. So the main focus of the show tonight is going to be Premier Automotive Group. And I've probably danced around this topic on this show before, like when I did a show about Jaguar like 2 years ago. But there was a time in the 80s and 90s when Ford was on a buying spree of a bunch of random European luxury brands. Ford had Jaguar, Land Rover, Volvo, Aston Martin, and then they inexplicably lumped Lincoln in with them under the same umbrella. And it lasted about 5 minutes and it cost them billions, but I'll talk about that. But first I want to start with some miscellaneous stuff. So a few weeks ago, I mentioned that a Ferrari Luce would be selling at RM Sotheby's at Monterey Car Week. And in fact, it would be the first Ferrari Luce, the first VIN, and it would be selling for charity. I assumed it would go for over $1 million because it's for charity and it's things go for stupid money when they go for charity. Well, in fact, it is over $1 million. In fact, it was $40 million. $40 million is not a small amount of money. Some would say it's quite a large sum of money. I don't know what the most expensive car to ever sell at auction is. Probably over $100 million. But $40 million, this thing's got to be in the top 100 most expensive cars to ever transact. I can't imagine spending $40 million on a car, and then that car is a Ferrari Luce. It's not like the buyer cares. It's probably nothing to that guy. But like, you can be absolutely certain this car will not be driven. Not because it's worth anything, but because nobody wants to drive it anyway. I don't like the precedent this sets. Like, I feel like this was staged. Because I think this is going to be rolled up into all the pro-Luce Ferrari propaganda that Ferrari's pushing these automotive publications to put out. You know, like a couple weeks ago, oh, they sold 500 of them to suckers who want to be the first in line for the next actually good car that Ferrari makes. But like, they sold the first year allocation. They're like, see, the critics were wrong. Ferrari sold out of Luces this year. How about that? It looks like it doesn't suck after all. And now I just feel like all the Ferrari bootlickers and Ferrari themselves are going to use this sale as a defense. Like, well, I don't know if $600,000 is too much money. This guy paid $40 million for his. Like, people must really want this thing. It's dumb. It feels like a psyop. And I get it was for charity, but like, that's it. Maybe it's a money laundering thing. But like, usually when someone spends $40 million on a car, it's because the car is an investment. They're buying it like a nice painting or a sculpture or something. Like, any other $40 million car will generally be worth something close to that or considerably more when it comes time to sell. This was $40 million straight down the drain. I ended last week's show by concluding that the worst car ever made, all things considered, was the Volkswagen Passat W8. But I said that ultimately it might be overtaken in the coming years by the Ferrari Luce. This is fuel to that fire. This is just building that case. Can you imagine spending $40 million on a car and then driving that car and it's this car? It blows my mind. And also, it's like, you know, what do you insure it for? You insure it for replacement value, which is like 600 grand. I mean, I get it was for charity, but I'm blown away by this whole situation. Apparently the buyer is a billionaire who donates a lot of money to charity. So it's like, that's what it is. But there are so many other things I'd rather end up with as a result of trying to piss away $40 million on a tax write-off. But, you know, fair play, more power to him. Next thing. So this will be brief. Chrysler is teasing a factory-lowered version of the Pacifica, which is their minivan. They're saying they want a stanced minivan. And honestly, they put out teaser shots of what this thing would look like, and it's lowered on like bigger wheels. And for a minivan, it's not bad. Like, I kind of like it. Sporty-looking minivans, I like. You know, every now and again, I'll see that early 2000s Dodge Grand Caravan Sport. It had a different front bumper and the spoiler and had big wheels. And I think, you know, it's actually a pretty good looking minivan. You know, I think these days, I think Chrysler kind of doesn't make ugly cars. And that hasn't been true ever. But think about it. For a minivan, the new Pacifica is quite handsome. You get a look at their other brands, like, okay, Jeep. It's the Compass is the weak link, but that's going to be going away soon. They're going to come out with a new one that looks better. Other than that, all the Jeeps are good. Dodge makes two cars. They make the Durango and the Charger. Both are pretty good looking. Ram makes a truck that looks good. Like, I think for as much crap as CDJR gets these days and what it deserves, you can't really fault their styling. They make pretty good looking stuff. Moving on. So the Toyota GR GT. I haven't talked about the GR GT lately. That's Toyota's new supercar. Apparently, Toyota has already sold all the allocations for that car. The senior vice president of automotive operations said that there were only 200 or 250 for the U.S. market. He didn't give the number for worldwide, but you have to assume it's not that many. But he said, we're not going to have enough to meet demand, and that's by design. It's a passion project and made because Akio Toyota wants a world-class performance car. We don't want to sell cars to flippers. We only want people who are going to drive it. Which is hilarious to me. I don't know about you. How is it that they think they can discourage flipping by limiting the number of cars they make? Like, hey, let's make none of these things and hype it all up. Nobody's going to try and flip it that way. It just wouldn't make sense. It's like, it's just a farce. And that's not really why they're doing it either. Like, they're limiting the production. If they're honest with themselves, it's because they remember the Lexus LFA. And as we've seen the last month or so, the Lexus LC500. Toyota and Lexus can offer people great cars all they want. But for whatever reason, it will be savagely unpopular new. The LFA existed. And when it was new, it was like a $300 or $400 sticker. Like, it was a really expensive car. And they could not give them away. Because it was way too much money for the level of performance and style, but it was deeply unpopular. It got to a point where Lexus Corporate was cold calling random wealthy people to try and talk them into building an LFA because they just had them sitting around. The last LFA sold was probably like 5 years old on the dealer floor. It was a sales disaster. But you know what? A couple years after that, LFAs are worth $1 million. I mean, don't get me wrong. That's massively overpriced. But the only way people will want a car like that is if you can't get them anymore. Same story on a much, you know, cheaper level with the Lexus LC500 lately. I think you can probably still find them on dealer lots for like $120 new. And it's been on sale for like a decade. Nobody wanted it when it was new. But everybody realized it was a great car and that Lexus was discontinuing it. So if you look at auction results lately, there are some pretty solid figures. People are buying these things for like $150. On a $120 car that you can still probably buy new at a dealer. It's ridiculous. So they're limiting the production of the GR GT probably because they know that nobody will actually want to buy one new. Because the precedent has been set. That's what Toyota is doing here. Just set a finite number. If they just make as many as people willing to buy, nobody's going to buy it because they have no motivation to. It's like it has to be limited. It has to be scarce in order for people to want it. No matter how desirable the car is. But anyway, Porsche. So a lot was made this week about the fact that Porsche is bringing back the manual transmission option in the 911 Carrera S. They're calling it the Carrera S MT package. MT means manual transmission, obviously. And it costs an additional $13,000 over an automatic Carrera S because they say that it comes with a bunch of other things, you know, included, but like they just know they can charge whatever they want for this thing. If it was another 50, people would probably still buy it. Used to be the Carrera S was like one step above the base model, but then like the Carrera T kind of adopted that from a pricing perspective a few years ago. So it's like the Carrera T is the same sort of level of performance as the base Carrera, but you can get it with a manual. The Carrera S is now two steps above base, but it's way faster. Used to be the Carrera S was one step above base, but it was like way more car. So that was the one you got. Nobody got the base Carrera. But anyway, reason I bring this up, the manual Carrera S costs $170,000. And the craziest thing is the 911's pricing has basically only ever kept pace with inflation. Like the prices go up on the 911 every year, but it always works out to roughly the same. We're at the point where a base model Porsche 911, an automatic Carrera with no options, is a 135 car. What the hell? I can remember like a decade ago, you could get a loaded out Corvette Stingray for the same price as a base Porsche 911. And maybe that's still true. I don't know. But like at that point, you were talking about an $80,000 car. That made a lot more sense than 135. You can go on Porsche's configurator now and spend crazy money if you want to. Granted, they're doing a lot more special editions now because, again, Porsche realized they can charge whatever they want because the boomers will act like every special edition 911 is a collector's item. But you can spend $400,000 on a new 911 if you want. Even a 911 Turbo is almost $300 nowadays. It's like $250,000. The base price of a 996 GT2, the king of the Porsches 20 years ago, was like $180 back in the day. And like just a regular Turbo is $250 now. How did this happen? And again, that didn't happen overnight. That's just inflation. Like when the C8 Corvette came out, the base price was $59,995. Now it's closer to $75,000. But like, damn, a base 911 is a $135,000 car now. So when you see the average price of a new car is like $50,000, that kind of makes sense. That's not that crazy. Because 50 is the new 30. Just where we're at. Anyway, so the main topic of the show, Premier Automotive Group. In the 80s and 90s, Ford bought a bunch of random European luxury brands and tried to make them all work together. And I'll go through each brand and kind of go through what happened with them and whether Ford was good or bad for them. But I'll start with an overview of Premier Automotive Group. So in 1987, Ford acquired a majority stake in Aston Martin. Then 2 years later, they bought Jaguar. In a few years into that relationship, Ford decided they had enough premium brands, which at that time was Aston Martin, Jaguar, and inexplicably they included Lincoln in this too initially. They rounded them up and put them under the watchful eye of a new Ford division formed in 1998 called the Premier Automotive Group. And the Premier Automotive Group was headquartered in California, and the idea was that this was a subsidiary of Ford that focused on their luxury brands. In their mind, like, these guys would focus on competing with the world and the best that the world had to offer. And then in 99, they bought Volvo and they bought Land Rover in 2000, and that kind of rounded it out. It was like Ford kind of went around and bought all the weird misfit luxury brands. But yeah, when all was said and done, Ford ended up losing billions and it was pointless and they don't have any of those brands anymore, except for Lincoln, which is like, yeah, shouldn't have been in there anyway. But I'll start from the top chronologically. So the first of the companies that Ford acquired that would make up Premier Automotive Group, well, apart from Lincoln, which I'll get to, but like the first was Aston Martin. Prior to Ford's ownership, Aston Martin was barely a company. Like their glory days really were the 50s and 60s, although they never really sold a lot of cars. But they especially weren't selling a lot of cars by the time Ford bought them. By the mid-80s, Aston Martin was selling dozens of cars a year. Even James Bond wasn't driving Aston Martins anymore. Roger Moore, as James Bond, never drove an Aston Martin on film. Although, you know, all through the 70s and most of the 80s, like, think about it. The franchise that people associate with Aston Martin, and you got to assume the main thing that makes people want an Aston Martin, the James Bond movies, didn't have any Aston Martins in them, which is probably fine because they basically made one sports car during that time. Like they were struggling, but anyway, around that time, the late 80s, Ford's competitors were buying up small European sports car companies. GM had Lotus, Chrysler bought Lamborghini. So Ford needed something like that too. So Ford took a controlling stake in Aston Martin in 1987. And they were a really small company. So Ford took ownership and gave them the resources they needed, and they revamped the factory and the production processes. They finished production of the Vantage, which had been on sale since the early 70s and not really been changed. 1989, they came out with the Virage. And the Virage wasn't all new. In fact, it was based on the Aston Martin Lagonda, which, if you look at it, was actually almost as old as the old Vantage. But still, it had all-new sheet metal. The Virage was a good car, and also never sold in huge numbers, probably because it was just so expensive. But it kept the company moving along. And also, as is a common theme here, the Virage had a lot of Ford parts. Just one example. By the mid-1990s, the Aston Martin Virage, which I should mention, the Virage cost like $250,000 back then. It had the same steering wheel as the original Ford Taurus. It just had an Aston Martin logo on it. It was ridiculous. But yeah, so that's how things were. Anyway. But in 1994, Aston Martin got its reboot. The DB7 came out. And in truth, the DB7 also had its roots in the 1970s because it was based on the Jaguar XJS, just heavily modified. Which by that point, Ford also owned Jag, so I'll get to that. But the DB7 had a body styled by Ian Callum. It was absolutely gorgeous. Nothing looked like it. And in fact, the DB7 was originally supposed to be Jaguar's replacement for the XJS. But Ford more or less decided Aston Martin probably needed it more, so they let Aston have it. And it set Jag back a bit, but 2 years later, they came out with the XK8, which was based on the DB7 platform, and the XK8 was a success for them. But anyway, the DB7, which I'll get to all that, the DB7 was a massive success for Aston Martin. The car was absolutely gorgeous. The quality was like so-so. The interior was kind of squeaky, but it drove fine. The main thing was it looked fabulous. It came with either a 4-liter straight six from the XJS or a new Ford-developed 5.9-liter V12, which I'll talk about that engine in a minute. But by the time the DB7 went out of production, almost half the cars that Aston Martin had ever produced were DB7s. And they kept building other stuff too, like the Vanquish, which kind of replaced the Virage. I mean, just in terms of hierarchy, because it was more expensive than the DB7 by a lot. Was the Vanquish measurably better in any way than the DB7? Not really. And in fact, the Vanquish was only offered with this awful single clutch automated manual, which that was a transmission that was so bad that if you own a first generation Vanquish now, Aston Martin themselves will, for a considerable fee, swap in a regular manual transmission, because even Aston Martin themselves realize how much the original flappy paddle gearbox ruined that car. But mainly, as Aston Martin's flagship, the car was so much more expensive than the DB7. Like, I remember seeing a thing from that period where there was a Vanquish next to a well-equipped Porsche 911 and a Ford GT, and the Vanquish was more expensive than both combined. Which is funny, because nowadays, that Ford GT alone would be like a $600,000 car, and that Aston Martin could be had for under 50. But you'd forgive that, because the Vanquish was just gorgeous. That car was also styled by Ian Callum, and I think the original Aston Martin Vanquish is one of the top three best-looking cars ever made. It was just unbelievable. And as a side note, with the introduction of the Vanquish, Aston Martin was back in James Bond movies. In fact, go watch any 2000s James Bond movie, any James Bond movie after The World Is Not Enough, because Bond had a partnership with BMW for a while through the 90s. But like, starting with Die Another Day, well, what was the hero car in Die Another Day? It was an original Aston Martin Vanquish. And also, there's a chase sequence with that car and a Jaguar XKR. And there were some Range Rovers, and early on in that movie, Bond is in Cuba where he drives an old Ford Fairlane. So there's some premier automotive group product placement. But Casino Royale is way worse about that. The hero car in Casino Royale was an Aston DBS, but there's a scene where some hotel guest mistakes James Bond for a valet and he has him park his Range Rover Sport because that car had just come out and I guess they wanted it featured prominently. Well, he backs it into a row of parked cars, but in that parking lot, every single car in that lot was a Ford product of some kind. Land Rover Discoveries, Jaguars, Lincoln Town Cars, there's a Ford 500 in that shot. There's no exceptions. There are dozens of cars in that scene. Everything is a Ford product of some kind. And also in that movie, James Bond drives a Ford Mondeo. So in other words, Ford not only got Bond to drive Aston Martins again, but every car featured in those Bond movies was under the Ford corporate umbrella. Ford spent real money on that product placement. Reports in period said that Ford spent $24.5 million for their cars to be featured in that movie. But anyway, yeah, Casino Royale. So the hero car is a DBS, which they brought the DBS name back from the 60s. And this time the DBS was the sportier, better looking version of the DB9, which the DB9 came out in 2004. And the DB9 replaced the DB7 and was somehow even better looking and also even sold better. But not as well as the smaller car based on the DB9, the new Vantage. The Vantage became Aston's entry-level car. It was supposed to compete with like a Porsche 911 or something like that. It was a small sports car. They sold something like 25,000 Vantages for that generation between 2005 and 2017. So 25,000 of those cars out of maybe 100,000 cars that Aston Martin as a company has ever made. And so prior to Ford's ownership of Aston Martin, I don't even think they made 10,000 ever. So if you could point to any company being a success story of the premier automotive group, it was Aston Martin. And that makes sense because like that was the one that that Ford had originally set out to have. They wanted Aston Martin. So for whatever you could say about the shape that Aston Martin is in these days, Ford made them a real car company. They really weren't one before. And on the Aston Martin thing, there was a lot of parts sharing between the brands that made up the premier automotive group, especially from a brand with a lot of resources to a company with no resources. No resources being Aston Martin. You see a lot of Volvo and Ford and Jag stuff in that generation of Aston Martins. In fact, the V12 engine that was in a lot of 2000s Astons shares a lot of architecture with the Ford Duratec V6. People claim that the V12 is just two V6s put together. It's not really true. Although some of the internals are the same, like pistons, valves, all sorts of stuff is the same between a Ford Escape engine and an Aston Martin one. And as a side note, in basically every car that engine was in, the top of the engine says 6 liters, like 6.0. But this is Ford we're talking about here. Like Ford's involved. It wasn't a 6.0, it was a 5.9. Just throwing that out there. But like the key on that generation of Aston Martins was just a regular Jaguar key, and then the fob was a Volvo one. But it had leather glued on to hide where it said Volvo. The Aston Martin navigation system was a Volvo system. Basically, everything in the interiors of those Astons was either Volvo or Ford switches, stocks, all of it, everything. Maybe that's one of the reasons that old DB9s and Vantages and things aren't considered disasters to own and maintain, because the V12 was a lot of Ford bits, and the V8 Vantage had a heavily reworked Jaguar AJ V8. So, like, if you need something like an airbag module, it's still, like, it's probably still a Volvo part number, but I'm going to guess you have to have it programmed by Aston Martin. Like, that's where it's difficult to own an old Aston Martin. But it's just stuff like that. Like, but overall, they're not that difficult to own, all things considered. I think that's why V8 Vantages have held their value lately, or gone up. I can remember when every single early V8 Vantage, less than 10 years after it came out, was a $30,000 car, down from, like, $120 new. But then everybody realized how cheap they were for what they, you know, offered. And worse than that, they weren't that awful to own and maintain. So the values actually went up. If you want a stick shift early Vantage nowadays, you're looking at, like, $50. But anyway, that's Aston Martin. I'll get to Jag and Volvo and Land Rover and Lincoln and what all happened to it after the break. I'll be right back. This is Jack's Car Show on NAMM Radio. Make sure the levels are right. I have to do this every week. I always forget, though. Okay. Be right back. Okay. There we go.
Summer taken, summer given back. skin. When does the strip begin?
All right, so I'm back. So, Premier Automotive Group. I talked about Aston Martin before the break. Let's move on to Jaguar. So, Ford had Aston Martin, but they knew they needed a more... This is early on. Ford had Aston, but they knew they needed a more mainstream luxury brand. So, initially, they looked at either Saab or Jaguar. Well, turns out General Motors was looking at the exact same two companies, and ultimately GM ended up with Saab and Ford ended up with Jag. I've talked on here before about how one of Jag's golden eras was early on during the Ford years, because Ford executives showed up at the Jag factory and they were just actively appalled at how bad it was, which says a lot because this is 90s Ford. Like, they weren't really known for cutting edge assembly processes themselves. So the first thing they did was spend a bunch of money to improve the Jaguar factory, and they came out with a redesigned XJ, and then in 96, the crown jewel of the Ford years, in my mind, the XK8. And for once, the quality was decent, and the cars looked great, and they drove great, and everything was going well for them during that time, at least at first. I think anything that Ford could have done to save Jaguar, they did, but that company is just... It's like every couple of years, Jag gets on some hot streak with some exciting new revamp products, and then they forget why people liked them in the first place, and then they lose it, and they crash and burn. 70s and 80s Jaguar was kind of lukewarm after the 60s were amazing. The 90s into the 2000s was very solid, but by the mid-2000s, they lost it. You know, they revamped their entire product line in the early 2010s, and they were doing really well. But in the early 2020s, it's like every year the sales are half of the previous year, to the point that these days it's like Jag doesn't even exist anymore. They know how to get people's attention. They just can't keep it. That, or like the people they're going after are kind of niche. It's possible, I guess, that everyone in the late 90s who wanted an XKA just bought one. And so accordingly, the demand dropped off. I don't know. But Jag has always had a hell of a time. But so back to the turn of the millennium, the XK8 was absolutely gorgeous. It was like their halo car. They had the S-Type, which launched in 1999. That wasn't gorgeous. In fact, it was absolutely heinous. But it was a great car. Under the Premier Automotive Group, Jaguar launched the X-Type, which was loosely based on the Ford Mondeo, and that was a decent car. The X-Type was their small car that was supposed to compete with the BMW 3 Series and stuff like that. It was fine. That era of Jag had some reliability hiccups, admittedly. It had a Nicosil cylinder liner thing from the late 90s. BMW had that issue, too. Some fuels with a high sulfur content would corrode the cylinder liners of the engines, which isn't really what you want. But overall, the engines that Jag was building under Ford were pretty solid. In fact, these days, Jag is known for V8s. Like, that's their thing. But they never had a V8 until 1996 with the XKA. Like, prior to that, it was all straight sixes and V12s. So a lot of the identity that Jaguar has was developed during the Ford years. But through the 2000s, actually Ford started to struggle. Like, they were posting big losses here and there. Not even just, like, because of the Jag brand specifically, but it didn't help. Jaguar tried to keep things fresh. They came out with an all-new design language with the model year 2008 XF, which replaced the X-Type. 2007, they had the new XK, which replaced the XK8, but it was newer, and it was like a cut-price DB9, but in a good way. Like, it was that 2007 XK was a great car. Jag made good cars in the 2000s, but it wasn't enough. But before that, let's talk about Volvo. Prior to Ford's ownership, Volvo was completely independent, and it wasn't like they were struggling either. Volvo was doing fine in the late 90s. Volvo just decided they wanted to focus more on the production of heavy equipment. You know, Volvo makes like semi-trucks and like boat engines and stuff like that. Plus, they wanted to invest some money into Mitsubishi, who at that time was doing quite well. So Volvo decided to sell the automobile side of the company to Ford. So Volvo became two companies, more or less. Volvo Group, who built trucks and things, and then Volvo Cars, which was a subsidiary of Ford. And I always felt like Volvo did quite well under Ford from a standpoint of the cars. Because prior to the Premier Automotive Group, Volvo was a small independent company. So whenever they wanted to come up with a new model, that was like a big deal for them. You know, they had to design and build every part of it in-house. And they usually had a small car, a medium car, and a big car. And then often a wagon version of any or all of those. And then there was like a coupe. It was usually the coupe version of the mid-size car. But, you know, like, that's simple. But under Ford, I think that, you know, they launched more models. I think they were ahead of the game when they came out with the original XC90 in 2003. I mean, arguably everybody at that point was rushing to do SUVs. It seemed like the obvious thing to do, but the original XC90 was just so good and forward thinking, and that car looks good and new today. Which it's not that old. We're talking about a 2003 automobile, but it's not that old, but still. Maybe that's why it was on sale for so long. 2006, Volvo came out with the C30, which was a little funky hatchback based on the Ford Focus. It had a 5-cylinder engine. It was kind of cool. And in fact, we didn't get that generation of Focus, and we really didn't get that generation of Focus ST in the United States, but we did get the Volvo C30 T5, which was basically the same thing, but better looking. The Volvo C30 has kind of been forgotten, but it was a cool car. And Volvo's regular cars became a lot more mainstream under the Premier Automotive Group. Volvo has just become so normal nowadays, but it was always a weird, quirky car brand, like Saab. It's just, in the past, Volvo was always about innovation and safety, and honestly, longevity. Like, Volvo buyers were just Mercedes buyers who couldn't afford a Mercedes. Volvo was the first company to install an odometer with 6 digits in their cars as a sign that they had faith the cars would make it that long. 100,000 miles, back when that was like a feat. No, nobody else thought about that. Volvo's made good cars. Not stylish ones, not super nice ones, but they were just good, practical, durable things. Under Ford, they made good cars, but in going after a wider audience, I feel like Volvo kind of lost what made them unique. Their cars are generally quite safe, but by that point, by now, like everything is. So Volvo it's not really making much of a statement anymore. It used to be the cars were absolutely heinous because it was the safest option. Like they had to make it heinous in order to have it be safe. But like everything's really safe now, and Volvo's cars look pretty conventional. I think they look good, but I'm just saying they look like cars. And Volvo's now are reasonably reliable, but not exceptionally so. Like I feel like Volvo kind of became redundant. And that was kind of the problem. Ford wanted to make Volvo more premium to compete with higher-end stuff instead of just banking on it being the small, quirky automaker that everyone knew and respected. They wanted Volvo to be like an Audi competitor. And as a result, despite making arguably better, more stylish, nicer cars and coming with new models, Volvo lost what made them unique, and not just that, like they lost overall market share and sales were falling by the end. So I think it's fair to say that despite my liking the cars, Volvo was worse off under Ford. So that's Volvo. Lincoln. There was a time when Ford actually stepped up their game with Lincoln. And I say that, you could probably point to one instance or another any time in the last few decades. But Ford got it in their head in the 90s that actually the Lincoln brand makes sophisticated automobiles for sophisticated Americans. They came out with that Mark 8, that big coupe with the 4.6-liter Intech V8. That was a great car and a great engine. It was a lot more work than they needed to do for the sales that car actually put down. But like they were trying. 98, Lincoln comes out with the Navigator, which started the whole full-size luxury SUV segment that just dominates everything today. Maybe that's why 98, they outsold Cadillac for the first time since the 40s. Lincoln in the 90s was something. And in 2000, they came out with the Lincoln LS, which was great. And in fact, 2000, that was Motor Trend's Car of the Year. But the key to this discussion, Lincoln LS was based on the new Jaguar S-Type, and it shared its engine. And Lincoln tried to pitch it as a sports sedan. It had 50-50 weight distribution. It had this new advanced European-style aluminum block V8. Like, it was good. It was based on the Jag S-Type. It was a good car. It didn't age that well. But for an American car company in the early 2000s, the Lincoln LS was a spaceship. And as a side note, the Lincoln LS shared a platform with the Jag S-Type, but also the 2002 Ford Thunderbird, which I should also mention was the 2002 Motor Trend Car of the Year. They really knew how to pick winners back then. 2000, the Lincoln LS, 2002, the Ford Thunderbird. And for what it's worth, 2001 was the Chrysler PT Cruiser. So, anyway, Lincoln. Ultimately, Ford realized correctly, and arguably they were delusional for not thinking it in the first place. They realized that Lincoln didn't compete with anything European or good. It competed with Cadillacs and stuff like that, not Mercedes or Lexus or the stuff that it would need to in order for it to make sense to be in the Premier Automotive Group. And they also realized that just because that one model, Lincoln LS, shared parts with other brands under the Premier Automotive Group, it didn't make sense to have the Lincoln division be controlled by them when basically everything else they built was some rebadged Ford or Mercury product. So in 2002, Lincoln was removed from the Premier Automotive Group, and that was that. I don't think it should have ever been in there, but whatever. So now let's get to Land Rover. Ford never originally set out to buy Land Rover. In fact, they had set out to buy BMW as a whole, because BMW had bought what was left of the Rover Group from British Aerospace, and they dumped way too much money into it. they were getting their clocks cleaned financially, and it looked like Ford, it looked to Ford like maybe they could slide in there and buy them out, and that never materialized. But BMW realized they were in trouble, so they tried to sell all the Rover stuff, but nobody really wanted such gems as the Austin brand or the Rover 600 series, but they did own Land Rover, and that was worth something. And yet again, Ford and General Motors got into a bidding war for Land Rover. And Ford won, and Land Rover was added into PAG. And I don't want to say that Land Rover didn't advance under Ford, because that isn't true. I think BMW did a lot of the legwork. Like, under BMW, Land Rover came out with the Freelander. They came out with the P38 Range Rover, which, as crappy as it was, the P38 was the first all-new Range Rover since the 70s. And it used a lot of BMW electronics and even engines. But, you know, like, under Ford's ownership, in terms of new products, there wasn't as much. They came out with the Range Rover Sport. The quality was definitely better. But, like, so, like, the L322 Range Rover, that was a BMW design. I always think that the L322 generation Range Rover is really interesting. That's the one sold between 2003 and 2012. It's probably the Range Rover that Americans think of when they think of a Range Rover. Well, that car was mostly developed under BMW. So the early cars had BMW engines and a bunch of BMW electronics, and they were crap. Those were the 2003 to 2005 ones. And those are the ones to avoid. If you're buying an L322 Range Rover, you shouldn't, but you should especially not buy an 03 to 05. Like, and because, okay, they had BMW V8 engines. I always say BMW has never designed a good V8 engine, and this had the engine from, like, a X5. That being said, in terms of style, in terms of fit and finish and performance and all that, the 2003 was a massive leap forward for the Range Rover. But they were just disasters. Like, I was watching Entourage not that long ago, which, if you're into looking at cars that were ridiculously expensive 20 years ago but depreciated to absolutely nothing, Entourage is the show. But that car stuck out to me specifically because it was an 03 to 05 Range Rover being driven by the wife of one of the main characters, and it's parked in front of their house in, like, Beverly Hills or wherever. And it's like, damn, that was the life those cars were living in, period. Realistically, I bet that car was in for a lot of warranty work in, period. But, like, nowadays, that exact car is probably $2,500 on Facebook Marketplace with a timing chain rattle and an air suspension leak if it isn't just in a junkyard. 03 to 05s were just garbage. Those were the BMW ones. For 2006, the car got a facelift. But the main thing was, it got a bunch of Jaguar stuff, the Jaguar AJ V8. And I'm not going to say that the AJ V8 is one of the best engines ever made, but, like, it was good, which is more than you could say about a BMW one. So the 2006 to 2009s, they still had some issues, but not really with the major mechanical components. It was still a British car, and the British don't know how to build anything, but the drivetrains were mostly fine. Those years were really where the Ford influence showed itself. But Jaguar and Land Rover were sold to Tata in 2008. And for 2010, they had a new engine, a 5-liter V8. And I'm not going to place the blame squarely on the Indians for that engine. It was probably mostly designed under Ford's watch. And in fact, it was built in a Ford factory for, like, a decade. But still, I'm lumping this in with the three eras of the L322 Range Rover. That 2010 and up Range Rover, plus basically every high-end Jaguar Land Rover product after that, had that 5-liter V8, and that engine has some major issues. Timing chain issues, like cooling system issues, water pump failures. They weren't good engines. But I just think the L322 Range Rover really sums it up. Under BMW, Land Rover sucked. Under Ford, they were pretty solid. Still not amazing, but, like, they were fine. They were, by Land Rover standards, they were great. And then under Tata, it was crap again. Although it seems like I'm giving Ford credit for if any of these companies succeeds or fails, it isn't like there's a bunch of Ford technicians sitting there designing new Range Rovers and things. The brands were more or less left autonomous. It's just, you know, whether they could succeed or fail given the money and resources, but also the restrictions and directions that come with being owned by a big conglomerate like Ford. Land Rover did fine. And I need to mention that Land Rover during that time really was trying their damnedest. Like, they were... It's easy to think now of the L322 Range Rover as being this cheap, unreliable used car, but they tried. For example, the key fob battery was rechargeable. It didn't have batteries you'd replace, and you didn't plug it into a wall or anything. Like but the key would always be charged by the car's ignition. There was a coil within the ignition barrel that supplied a current to the car's key to charge it while you were driving, so you never had to replace a key fob battery. And in later years, in other markets besides ours, the center screen in a Range Rover could display two things at the same time, depending on whether you were in the passenger seat or the driver's seat. Meaning that depending on the viewing angle, it would show something different. So, like, the passenger can be watching a DVD while the driver is looking at the navigation on the same screen at the same time. It was cool stuff. But again, that kind of stuff wasn't really enough to keep Ford interested in Land Rover. But by the mid-2000s, Ford was losing their shirt on Premier Automotive Group and just in general. So one by one, they sold off the brands. And I'll talk about that after the break. I'll be right back. This is Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio. So I'm back. So it's the late 2000s and Ford is not doing well. 2006, they lose something like $13 billion. So they need to let some stuff go. So in mid-2007, they announced that they were putting Jaguar and Land Rover up for sale. And on January 1st, 2008, they announced that Tata Motors was the highest bidder. Tata, makers of the Nano, the Nano being the cheapest new car for sale anywhere in the world, that car sold brand new for the equivalent of about $2,500 when it came out in 2008, the same year as this transaction. it was a death trap, but that's the kind of thing that Tata was known for, not big English luxury cars. And I should clarify, when Tata took over at first, they really tried. They spent some money. They were putting out good stuff. Now, exactly what parts were Ford and which were Tata, it gets kind of blurry in a lot of cases. But in the early years of Tata's ownership, like those new engines came out, they redesigned the Jaguar XJ, they made it look like a new modern car. The L460 Range Rover came out, Land Rover got an all-new design language. Jaguar got the F-Type, the Range Rover Evoque came out. Like, all this cool stuff happened. But it was like early 2000s infinity. Like, JLR came out with all this stuff, and it was really great. But they felt like they could coast on that and not really try all that hard. And so Jag was ultimately left to languish, and that's why they're in the state they're in. Land Rover's certainly doing better, but even still, they made that 5-liter V8 until last year, and it still had issues until the end. They just never addressed it. There were V6 versions of it too, same sorts of problems. The new Range Rover, the one that came out, like the current one, the one that came out for 22, I'm not disputing that's a great car. It looks identical to the old one. Same with the Range Rover Sport, same with the Evoque. The Defender is great, and they're coming out with a smaller one, but I just feel like they don't have to do that much with the Land Rover brand. In fact, I was thinking about the Range Rover the other day. I'm sure there's people who have the current one who didn't notice that it's new compared to the like 2013 one. They look the same. I bet you there's people who lease one of those every 2 or 3 years and they just didn't notice that it was that different. But anyway, and I get it's an off-road brand. You don't have to try that hard necessarily. Like the Jeep Wrangler has looked the same forever and that still sells well. Big luxury SUVs are where it's at in terms of not having to try very hard. Just ask the Mercedes G-Wagon. It doesn't matter how relatively crappy or outdated something like that becomes. There's always going to be a certain segment that's going to buy them. There's never going to be a time when people in Beverly Hills or Palm Beach don't buy Range Rovers. So Jaguar, Land Rover, we'll see what happens there. And actually, the first brand under the Premier Automotive Group umbrella to go was Aston Martin. Ford dumped them in 2007, but they retained a minor stake. In the year since Ford sold them, Aston Martin went off on their own. They're arguably independent, although, you know, Ford still owns their 8% share, and Mercedes owns a 5% stake because Mercedes supplies their engines now. And Aston Martin is now a publicly traded company, and they seem to be okay. I mean, not great. They have a lot of debt, and sales aren't as good as they'd like. The problem, people, Aston Martin, people like Aston Martins, generally. But nobody buys them for a number of reasons. Like, the depreciation is intense. Reliability is always is just a question mark. But now that they have Mercedes engines, I sort of think that when this generation of Vantages gets cheap, that'll be a solid used car buy. But Aston Martins are kind of a tough sell because they aren't really in the same ballpark as all the other exotic brands. Plenty of guys make a bunch of money off crypto or you know, whatever like that, and they buy a Lamborghini or a McLaren because it's flashy and crazy. Aston Martin doesn't really have that market. They never have. They're in this weird middle ground of being extremely cool, but also kind of boring. You know, crypto bros buy Lamborghinis, but the boring exotic car buyers, 70-year-old men, buy Porsche 911s. Or like, Aston Martin's thing was always, it was sporty, but also kind of luxurious. Well, nowadays, everybody knows to just buy a Mercedes AMG or a BMW M car or something like that, if that's what you want. So Aston isn't really stealing sales away from any of that stuff. And in fact, the fact that it's such a horrible investment with horrible depreciation compared to all that other stuff, it's a tough sell, which is a drag because Astons are so cool, but it's the reality. I don't know how much longer Aston Martin can exist in its current form. Volvo was the last to go. In fact, at first Ford acted like they weren't even planning to sell Volvo at all, but they did. They were bought by Geely in 2010. They're now owned by the Chinese. And for their first several years under Geely, things were going amazing for Volvo. Sales were up year over year. They had a bunch of new smaller SUVs. Volvo was really killing it, at least by Volvo standards. You know, back to the XC90, something that I don't think gets talked about enough is the XC90 and just how good it is. That car's been on sale since 2003. It's been redesigned once. The original was facelifted and updated a few times, as has the current one, but like, it was basically the same vehicle between 2003 and the 2015 model year. Those were different markets, let me tell you. 2003 and 2015, but like, they were still selling in 15. The current one came out for 16, and that gets me thinking about used ones pretty regularly because you can get an early current XC90 for like 12 grand if you want, and it looks pretty much exactly like a brand new $70,000 luxury SUV. But the fact is, it came out for 2016. We're going into the 2027 model year. The XC90 is still solid. But there are two very good generations of car that nobody really thinks about. These days, it seems like Volvo, for the most part, is doing okay, at least worldwide. In the U.S., it seems like they're a little iffy because they invested a lot of money in EVs with their Polestar brand. And so in places like China, where people buy a lot of EVs, I think they're doing well, but Americans don't really buy EVs that aren't Teslas these days. So in the States, Polestars aren't a huge hit. And I believe I'm correct in saying the Polestar 2 was subject to massive tariffs. And so they pulled it from the U.S. market. They're trying to sell Polestar 3s and 4s now. I don't really see a lot of those out driving around. As for Volvo as a brand, I'm just not really sure what is the appeal of a Volvo anymore. Because I'm not saying they're bad cars. They're not. They're quite good. But just so is everything else. There's not really any bad cars these days. So for a Volvo, it's like performance is whatever. Reliability and build quality is whatever. The styling is fantastic. Every new Volvo is gorgeous. But is that it? You want a good-looking car? Is that the reason you'd buy one? I just think that more people care about the car's brand and how flashy it is more than like how handsome the car is. So why not just buy a BMW or something? And that's, I think, what people do. Now, overall, I'm not convinced that Volvo's old buyer base is anymore. I said earlier that Volvos used to be bought by Mercedes buyers that couldn't afford a Mercedes, and I feel like that's basically true. And I'm talking about Mercedes 40 years ago, like when people with money would buy a Mercedes because it was big and sturdy and reliable and safe. It was the highest quality car that you could get. Not necessarily the most luxurious or the most technologically advanced. I mean, it was up there for sure. But you bought a Mercedes for the quality. That was who was buying Volvos mostly. Just maybe those sorts of people who were poor or had autism or something, like architects, stuff like that. They made a conscious effort to buy a Volvo because it was built like no other car. And they were happy to have this quirky Swedish thing. You know, like Saab people, actually. But nowadays, those people probably just lease whatever, you know, comes in the color they like. They'll end up in a BMW X3 or some crap like that. But anyway, so the Premier Automotive Group, when all was said and done, Ford lost billions. Ford spent $2.5 billion on Jaguar, $2.7 on Land Rover. So $5.2 invested between those two. And in the sale, they maybe netted $1.7. Ford spent $6.45 billion on Volvo, and they sold it for $1.8. It was never really reported how much Ford paid for Aston Martin. Estimates put it around $40 million at the end of the 80s, and they sold it for $925 million in the 2000s, which makes sense because, again, Ford brought Aston into the modern era. They made it a real car company, so maybe they made some money there. But millions don't offset billions. But when you think about it, Aston Martin might be the only brand that's definitively better off after being owned by Ford. Prior to Ford, they were still making the 70s V8 Vantage. After Ford, they were making the 2000s V8 Vantage and selling tens of thousands of them. It's a pretty big step forward. Ford's ownership definitely improved the quality of Jaguar. Sales are pretty iffy by the end. Land Rover was certainly doing better than Jaguar in terms of sales, and certainly in terms of the massive step up in terms of quality over the Rover and BMW years. But it never really did well enough to justify the investment. I think really what it comes down to with Land Rover is that on a long enough timeline, Ford really could have done great things with Land Rover. It's just that Ford dumped billions into the whole PAG thing right before the sales of their own cars slowed and the world went into a financial crisis. I tend to think, though, that Land Rover is still better off today having been owned by Ford, even if Ford couldn't really, you know, take them to their fullest. And as I spoke about with Volvo, Volvo's in kind of a tough spot right now. Volvo sales were slowing down by the end of the Premier Automotive Group years. Their cars, while maybe nicer and considered higher end, kind of lost a lot of what made Volvo successful in the first place. So was Ford good for Volvo? Probably not as good as they were bad for them, but I don't know. When all was said and done, Volvo being owned by the Chinese might be a good thing for them. I guess technically Lincoln is the last PAG car still under the Ford corporate umbrella, and that's not going to change, because why would it? As far as I can tell, both Ford and Lincoln are doing fine. Lincoln sells a lot of Nautiluses and Navigators, Nautili and Navigators. They sell fewer Aviators, but that's all that brand sells these days. There's three of them. The Nautilus, the Aviator, the Navigator. There's rebadged, higher trim versions of Ford SUVs. But if that's their niche and they can make it work, great. I wouldn't say that overall the Lincoln brand was all that affected by the whole Premier Automotive Group thing. So in other words, Ford lost billions of dollars, which, okay, it was the mid to late 2000s. Losing billions of dollars was the style at that time. And overall, most of the brands involved in this whole thing were worse off afterwards. That being said, Aston Martin probably wouldn't exist nowadays if not for Ford's involvement. So in my mind, that makes the whole thing worth it. Aston's still around. These days, but they're still there. That's all that matters. But anyway, that's all I have for tonight. I keep running short, and I don't know why. I don't know if I'm just talking faster or I'm just playing shorter songs or what, but anyway, that's all I got tonight. I'm going to go ahead and run through the damn radio schedule. So tomorrow, Tuesday, 7:30 to 9, International Flavor with Sam Trapp. 2 to 4, Really Big Shoe with JR. International Flavor is Monday through Thursday. Really Big Shoe is Monday through Friday. Wednesday, International Flavor, 9 to 10 a.m., The Damn Swag with Jimmy Tebow. Probably a repeat, or they got the Gathering of the Juggalos going on right now. 11 to 1, The Gabby Hayes Show with Gabby Hayes, Really Big Shoe. Thursday, International Flavor, Really Big Shoe. 4 to 6, Search of Solutions with Josh. That's Thursday and Friday. Friday, 7 to 8:30 a.m., Civic Outlaws with Sam Trapp. 9 to 10 a.m., Nadine at 9. Really Big Shoe. 4 to 5:30, Search of Solutions with Josh Butterfield. Ion Solutions with Josh and Pauly. 5:30 to 7-ish. And then 7 to 8, Eye of the Beholder with Pauly. Back again Monday, International Flavor. 9 to 10:40, Shield Maidens of Missouri, Stacey Shore, Lisa Panette, Really Big Shoe. And I think I should be back next week. I don't think I have anything going on next weekend. But anyway, this has been Jack's Car Show on Damn Radio. Thank you for listening.